Welcome to the Daily Friend Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. Welcome back from what was hopefully for most of you a long weekend. And we are jumping right back into the news with two of my colleagues. I'm, of course, your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you this fine Monday morning or afternoon, rather?
I must say I'm not suffering too much from a long weekend, post-long weekend depression, so that's good.
That's always a good place to be. And Mr. Gabriel Krauser, who is currently out in the wilderness somewhere on the far reaches, and therefore his signal and sound may be a little bit dodgy, but Gabriel, how are you today?
Good. No long weekend for me, but it's good to be out here in rural KZN, good to be chatting with you guys.
Very good. Right, let's jump right into it. And this is a bill that's been going around, proposed by the Gauteng ANC government. It's now gone out for public consultation and comment. And what the bill seeks to do, it seeks to develop Gauteng's township economies. It's called the Gauteng Township Economic Development Draft Bill. But it has a particularly contentious clause, which is basically that it looks like it will restrict economic activity in townships, specifically to citizens and people with permanent residency status. So this means that a lot of foreigners would be excluded from participating in the township economy legally. Herman, what should we make of this bill? Is this good thing?
Well, it's most definitely a thing, and I don't think we should be surprised by it. And just apologies beforehand if I sound a bit echoey. It's because I've recently moved into a new flat, and it's mostly just me and a chair. But at least I can now officially say that I will
work
in an echo chamber. Which, I mean, you know, our critics are sometimes right. So I don't think anyone should be surprised about this foreign-phobic bill or this idea, because the ANC has been, I mean, this for at least the last 10 years now, and probably more, probably like the last 12, increasing blame shifting for, I think, the last decade of economic and socioeconomic failures has been really a calling card for ANC governments across the country. And it seems to me that the us versus themism of the ANC is still as firmly ingrained as it has always been. It's part of, you know, a form of ethno-nationalism. It's part of a misplaced sense of South African exceptionalism. And I think what should also be made very clear is that the business community, corporate South Africa, seems to regard the Northwest and the Eastern Cape and the Northern Cape and Mpumalanga and the ANCs in those, the provincial ANCs in those provinces, to be, you know, the backward ones, and the ANC in Gauteng, these are the enlightened cadres. And even the enlightened cadres, you know, play these petty politics of, you know, identitarian division. And I just think that's awful. We sometimes get criticized at the Institute for being perhaps not, you know, pro foreigner, but we are pro people who want to make it through hard work. And I'm a very big proponent of legal immigration. I think the failures on immigration and the number of illegal immigrants in this country is absolutely squarely the fault of government. I don't think you can blame people who really just want a better life. I think that's a human instinct that at least classical liberalism and capitalism tries to, you know, give manifestation to. But I do think that this is just such a dangerous step in the wrong direction. It's this whole nativism idea of South Africans first. And my concern is it's a very, very small step from South Africans first to white people first or black people first. It's just once you start considering people not as individuals valuable to a community in their own right, then I think you're down a very, very dangerous and slippery slope that we as a country have been down before. And I think, ironically, what you will see if this, 1950s apartheid-style designated area legislation goes through, you won't see flourishing of locally owned spaza shops because the foreign cockroaches or the foreign alien plants have been rooted out. You will just see a decline in overall productivity if you exclude economically and commercially productive people from the economy. I think this is utter madness. It'll just end up making people poorer.
So, of course, we've seen in this country a lot of violence against foreigners, seeing it sort of anti-foreigner stuff created in legislation is, I think, a little bit worrying. Although I think there are quite a few foreigners with permanent residence. I'm not actually sure what the numbers are. So there will at least presumably be some foreigners who will continue to practice their trade. Gabriel, you've spent a lot of time with foreigners living in South Africa, in the inner city. What's your take on this piece of legislation?
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit different in the sense that I think it's not just about identitarianism. There's something else at play here. If you look at the history of spaza shops in South Africa, they serviced the majority of South Africans' retail interests for many decades. And then after 94, their market share, as compared with groceries, with formal retailers, decreased precipitously. And that is because your major, your ShopRites and Pick and Pays and even some Willys sort of slowly but surely came to realize that they could establish pretty large ventures in or on the outskirts of townships that would be safely guarded and well used. Initially there was a lot of fear about shoplifting being problematic, and then it turned out to be like everywhere else, if managed right. And a big retailer has economies of scale on his side. From a logistics point of view, what a spaza shop is addressing, the real need it's addressing, is getting the goods closer to your door. And it's just easier to do that if you have a major logistics network at your back. And then the surprise was, from 80% of groceries in townships being spaza bought to 20% as the formal retailers grew, it then tipped back to 80-20 the other way. I'm getting this data from Cassinomics by Gigi Alcock, roughly speaking. And that new growth all came from foreign-owned spazas. And so the question there to answer is, why have foreign-owned spazas outperformed established local traders? And that in itself is a hard question to answer. A lot of people will come up with foreigners are just more willing to steal, or they've got better social networks. I don't think that these address the real competitive advantages, because of course the local spaza traders were well established and had a long history, and they took a knock from the grocery stores. But there clearly was a marketable way to fight back, and it was done. And I think part of the reason is, if you drill pretty deep. And I did this with Rian Milan for the Institute of Race Relations in, I think it was the end of 2016, 2017. And we went out and we surveyed scores, I think 60 in total Spaza shops, and then looked at border data surveys from the Alcocks. And what we found was that the incentive structure was just set up such that foreigners couldn't own land, whereas locals were being granted RDP houses that were convenient locations to transform into spazarets or spaza shops. So a very natural fit would be for a local to lease out or rent out his place and make a profit, and for the foreigner to move in and do the trade. And then asking locals and foreigners, what do you think their competitive advantage is? The most common answer was they don't drink. They don't, you know, either Coptic Christians from Somalia or Ethiopia, or Muslims, Bangladeshis, people who came here from such harsh environments that for them, you know, for a family of four or five to be living off of 1,500 rand a month in terms of food costs and sleeping in their own stores was just a much better life than what they had beforehand. And if you can do that for long enough, then you can build up enough stock that you can start growing your business and enjoying a bit of a better lifestyle. And we spoke to some guys who'd gotten here 15 years ago and by this stage were taking in literally millions in turnover a month because they were climbing up the value chain in terms of distribution. So, you know, I think that the deep problem that the ANC is confronted with is this very lived reality for millions of South Africans, whereby you see that if you've got a government incentive, basically for rent seeking, then it's very tasty in the short run because you can free up your time, you get a bit of a passive income, and it looks like you can then go do business elsewhere. But the township economy is generally so depressed and repressed because of the fact that the whole economy hasn't grown in real terms, at least since 2013, that it is very hard to find another opportunity. And then you end up sitting on that passive income as your sole income. And that's a bit of a bleak state to be in. I mean, it's quite nice if you're getting an early retirement, but it's actually leaves you with very little room for growth. So I think that, in other words, to put it in brief, you've got a capitalist system on the one hand, which is the spaza traders, and then you've got a sort of government network, patronage network system on the other hand. And it's humiliating to ANC caterers who want township people to believe that the patronage network is really the fastest and most secure ladder up. For millions of people to be confronted by a reality that contradicts that point of view. So this is not at all to dispute that there isn't huge xenophobia, but I think that xenophobia is generally concentrated amongst young men. Our experience of talking to old gogos and malumes was that they were very keen on protecting their local spaza shop owner, whether he was a Somalian, a Bangladeshi, an Ethiopian, a Zimbabwean, whatever. You know, people have got good relationships. They're trusted traders. They often extend credit at no interest. That's another thing, especially about the Muslim traders. They don't charge you interest if they extend credit. It's a nice competitive advantage from a customer's point of view. So they want those people to be protected. But there's an angry young vanguard that wants to attack them, and that is definitely part of the political equation. But I think another part of the political equation is that these guys, kind of more than anyone at the coalface of the township economy, are proving that in terms of value add from a customer experience point of view and from wealth accumulation from an entrepreneurial point of view, the patronage network just ends up being second best to simple basic capitalism. And I think that it's for that reason that we spoke to traders and to officials back in 2016 who were looking to legislate to ban, already in the case of liquor, foreigners can't get a liquor license. So the last traders that are still going, generally in Soweto, Alex and so on, are running shebeens more than spaza shops. But people were talking, government officials were setting up spaza shops, sponsoring them, and they'd fall flat because they'd end up charging more, and then talking about legislating to prevent foreigners from getting in there. Yeah, part of it's a bit of xenophobia, but I think a lot of it is just trying to repress an economic system that doesn't fit into the broader ideological framework of the Tripartite Alliance and its junior league member of the EFF.
Very interesting stuff. And of course, just a reminder that bill is open for public comment if you would like to participate in the process. Doesn't always work, but it's usually worth a shot if one is concerned about these things. And I'm sure the IRR will be talking more about this in the future. Anyway, let's go on to our next story. And this is, of course, Gabriel, you're in KZN for many reasons right now, but we've recently seen a terrible, you did a documentary recently, you were in a documentary, about a terrible murder in Newcastle of a couple. Gabriel, do you want to tell us a little bit about what's kind of going on there and what you've been doing?
Yeah, so on the last Saturday of winter of August, Glenn and Vita Rafferty were murdered on their home on a farm on the way back from dinner with friends. And the Saturday after that, the Institute was down in Newcastle to record a peaceful protest that I think really set an example for how people can deal with this difficult thing in a dignified way. 3,000 people came together across class, creed, color to just say this is not acceptable. And it's not acceptable that rural South Africa is so vulnerable and so many people are open to predation, whether it's petty theft, stock theft, crop theft, car theft, home robberies, and ultimately murder. And people wanted more police capacity. They wanted, you know, the big sign said Ramaphosa, how many more must die, because he said there are no farm murders in this country. But although there was a firm stand against government complacency, there was also a very warm, open hand. I think that was great. Community members that I've spoken to since then have said that the atmosphere continued to be hopeful and ambitious to track down the killers and to bring justice and to also make a more systemic improvement to the situation around here. I've spoken to community members who said some of the provincial top police came through and said, you know, we see that this community's actually outgrown the police capacity that it currently has, so we will increase staff and allotments and look at that. But then came the Imbizo, where the KZN Premier was here, the Minister of Police was here, and the cameras were here, and that quickly devolved into a story about, you know, one community member said this is just all our problems come from white people, and the police, they only come here when a white person is killed, they don't come here when a black person is killed. Becky Taylor answered that by saying, "Don't worry, we're not afraid of white people." Rather than sort of getting to the root problem of that statement. And since then, I've spoken to farmers, farm workers who say people are chilling to each other. The friendly hellos are starting to go awry. And this morning I was at the magistrate's court where Siyabonga Goodman Matu was to have a bail hearing. He has reportedly confessed to being involved in the killing, although people who have been on the crime scene and I think are well-informed sources say that there was certainly more than one person involved. Looks like quite a few people were involved. Anyway, it was his bail hearing. There was another small gathering outside, very peaceful, asking that he not be granted bail. And he himself withdrew his bail application. The media spin was immediately that he's afraid of going out because he's worried that white farmers will kill him in reprisal. But I think, given the nature of this, of what's going on here, I think it's much more likely that he's afraid of his co-conspirators coming to shut him up forever. Anyway, it's, who knows exactly what his reasons are for preferring not to get bail. But as I came out of the magistrate's court, there was a guy from the Landless People's Movement who, I must say, I've collaborated with that movement before in other parts of rural KZN. And some of their membership are really quality, very poor, and trying very hard to make things right. But here we had the other side and an EFF guy, Lucky Shabalala, who's been posting Kill the Farmer on Facebook. And they were chanting, Panzi, Amabunu, Panzi, down with the farmer, down with the farmer, down. And it was just quite a stark thing to see outside a bail hearing for a murder trial. People actually chanting down with the Zulu. Anyway, so I tried to film that. They confronted me. I put my camera away. I really wanted to carry on, but I've only got one phone here, and I'm still in rural KZN for a while, and I need that phone. So I stopped recording, which I'm a bit irritated about. I then had some dialogue with those guys. I suppose I'll write a further report on what they had to say. But generally, it just feels like there's two Newcastles here. There's one that is very concerned with preserving law, and that says a law is a law and a life is a life, and they both need to be respected by everyone, and that it's in everyone's best interest to do so. And then there's another side that wants to say that this is a world of black versus white, and it's very concerning, a lot of violent language. Also had a report of EFF gathering on Friday after the Imbizo, three fires were set on neighboring farms to the Rafferties around then. One witness says he saw one of the EFF guys come along there. Not sure that you can directly blame the party, but you know, it's one of those factors that's just making people feel very unsafe and very worried. And I think pulling together a bit tighter, but, you know, not as much across the historic divides as had been the case before. And I think Glenn and Vita Rafferty very sorely missed here right now, known to be mediators, known to be people who came in here at a time when Normandine and Newcastle farming was quite divided, and who brought communities together and built trust and were generous, especially this year, you know, but especially this year, obviously, with the virus and the plague and the lockdown and so much of no work and no food, you know, I think there's some very heartbreaking stories, actually, and our colleague Sihle Ngubesi, Big Daddy Liberty, he's recorded some of them. I've spoken to some other people, continue to do so, who were very close to the Rafferties and feel very bitter and very sad, especially by the way that it's being cast as a black and white thing, because a lot of their closest supporters were not white, and think it's a disgrace. You know, that's kind of the message I'm getting from them. It's just a disgrace for them to have been killed like this, and then for their memory to be trampled on in this way. So as I say, a tale of two Newcastles, and we'll keep bringing you more details on that as they unfold.
I will look forward to that, Herman. The IRR has developed some strategies to try and help with rural security.
Yes, and I spoke to Gabriel about this when we launched it, and it, essentially it's a 5-point plan to save rural South Africa, and it's actually relatively simple. Firstly, make it easier for the citizen to defend themselves and their property through relaxing gun rights legislation and regulations, to make sure that you make it easier for the responsible citizen to become a gun owner, because the current system actually works against the responsible citizen, exactly the kind of person you would want to be able to use that level of force in extreme circumstances. Secondly, is to make police forces accountable to local communities. Part of that is merit-based appointments rather than political or race-based appointments. Part of that is making station commanders democratically electable or accountable to local communities. Thirdly, property rights. Fourthly, infrastructure investment. And then finally, a focus on job creation. And these 5 points really could work together to have a broad, stronger basis for rural South Africa. But I do think that what's at the heart of these 5 points and what I could pick up from what I could read and listening to Gabriel is the real tragedy is exposed by this horrific incident, this murder, is that, without sounding glib, there really is nothing more terrifying than hearing someone say, "I'm from the government, I'm here to help." It really, I think what Gabriel told us just now just illustrates that as long as when the community were, as it were, the drivers of a narrative, the drivers of a conversation, the drivers of social reaction or communal reaction to this horror, there was collaboration and reconciliation and non-racialism and really just the best you would want to see in a community suffering such bereavement. And then the turning point in that attitude seems to be the moment a bull in a china shop from the government steps in and allows the issue or actively participates in the issue becoming racially divisive. And I just think that cuts to the heart of why we are classical liberals is we say that, you know, just give people a fighting chance, whether it's to protect their lives and property and their loved ones, or whether it's to own a farm, or whether it's to have a job. Just give people a fighting chance. The government's job should be that, to give people a fair go at life. And I just think this shows that where government exceeds, where government just misreads, and where government just becomes so drenched in its own ideology and its own interests rather than the individual and the individual within their community, then I think you see the toxicity that gives rise to, you know, really the scum of South African politics.
Indeed. All right, let's move overseas now for our final story of today. This is a story that's making quite a lot of international headlines, and I thought maybe we could give a slightly different take on it. And this is that apparently, according to a report by the New York Times newspaper, Donald Trump has only paid $750 in federal income tax in 2016 and 2017. The newspaper, which says that it has tax records for Trump and his companies over the last two decades, says that he also paid no income tax in 10 of the previous 15 years, basically because he claimed that, I think it was mostly because he claimed that he was making a loss. Trump responded by saying, "It's fake news, it's totally made up. Everything was wrong, they are so bad. I've paid a lot, and I've paid a lot of state income tax too," he said. New York Times has said that it is not going to release its copies of Trump's tax filings, saying that they were protecting sources. We don't have much time left, only a couple of minutes, but Gabriel, in 60 seconds, what's your take on this story? Do you think the New York Times is telling the truth? And do you think it's something
I don't trust the New York Times, and I don't trust Donald Trump. You know, they both have contradicted themselves. They've both been contradicted by reality. I think it's kind of tragic and hilarious that that it's become this sort of talking point idea that you'll get Trump voters to defect by showing that he's actually not that rich. I don't think people are – I think that's really misreading the situation of why people would want to vote for Trump. On the other hand, I think it's kind of an indictment on America's democracy at this point. You know, it really is arguably the greatest democracy on earth. But at this point – I think it is somewhat shameful that that they have a president who over the years has been subject to tax investigations. I've spoken at length about his connection with Felix Sater. You know, I think that you really want in a president an upstanding citizen, and I think Trump has failed in that regard in terms of tax transparency. Being the first president not to disclose his tax returns publicly is a real problem, you know, it's systemic. It's an indication of how broken their bi-party system had become, that people wanted this change maker and were willing to kind of take that on the chin. So yeah, it's actually nothing new, but it's not great either way. But I don't think it's particularly important.
Hang on, 30 seconds.
Yes, I think two points. Firstly, is I think Gabriel is quite right in speaking about the upstanding citizenship issue. One of my favorite ideas about constitutional philosophy is Edmund Burke's idea that the state is divided into the symbolic and the functional. The Brits have it quite, you know, that division is quite clear. You've got the prime minister, the functional governor, and then you've got the monarch, the symbolic governor. And I think that works well. But in America, you have one and the same. So Donald Trump, the president, should be both the symbolic and the functional head of government and head of state and so on. And I think on a functional level, Trump has been relatively successful. And I think you can give him a lot of credit for many things, perhaps not his handling of the coronavirus. But on a symbolic level, there is a responsibility to be a symbol of unity. And I hate the phrase, but I'm going to use it because it says a lot. And I don't have a lot of time. Is, you know, a father of the nation figure. So that's the first thing, is I think that's absolutely right, that you can be both critical of Trump in this regard, but both acknowledge that he's been a good functional president in the main. And then the last point is, I don't think that this will change anything. The last time there were similar rumors of this, and Trump, you know, his reaction was it made him smart if he was able to dodge taxes. And I don't think anyone will really find this as a surprise. I mean, this will be like a sex scandal for Bill Clinton just before a re-election.
Indeed. Anyway, we'll have to see what happens. But thank you, gentlemen, and thank you to all of our listeners. We'll see you tomorrow on the Daily French Show. Have a great week, everyone.